Well, in the second half, we have a one-on-one with the outspoken Stephen A. Smith, and we'll do that right after this. Stephen A. Smith in studio, Straight Shooter, a memoir, which is a memoir of second chances and first takes. And it's available as you hear this in bookstores everywhere. Good to see you again, Stephen A.
Good to see you, man. How you doing? How's everything?
I'm doing good. I'm a fan of yours.
Thank you, man.
And I realize I'm now at the point where I'm just a fan of anyone who gives their opinion.
Right.
And I don't even care if I agree with it or not.
Right.
And I'm not saying I disagree with your opinion.
Sure.
I'm just saying anyone who's shooting straight, I just believe it's your opinion.
Right.
And I don't care if it's you or Charles Barkley or whoever. I go, right. If that's your opinion,
yeah,
then I'm a fan.
I'm a little bit different than you in that regard. I mean, on one hand, I'll adopt that thinking. I mean, I do have that thinking. I totally appreciate it. But you got to have some idea of what the hell you're talking about, too. You got a lot of people that spout off at the mouth and they engage in no research whatsoever. They have no rhyme or reason. You can throw facts in their face and they don't give a damn.
No, agree.
You got to give a damn about the facts.
Oh, I agree with that, but I will get you to a baseline of me appreciating you if I believe you believe what you're saying,
okay,
even if it's wrong.
Okay. That's true, too. That's true, too. So, in other words, we're both allergic to liars, and we have no affection or affinity whatsoever for somebody who's intentionally dishonest and disingenuous. I can go with that.
But, you know, you have to earn your way into that position.
Yeah.
And there's a number of guys, you know, there's your Charles Barkleys, your Howard Sterns or whatever, and you go, those guys have made their living speaking their mind.
Right.
It's easy once you get to that place, but getting to that place is tough because that's where you get a lot of criticism and sometimes even deplatformed or fired.
Yeah, so no question.
Was that always a mindset for you, or
always,
did you go, I'm playing the game for a little while until I can get in?
No, that was always my mindset. I started off as a newspaper reporter, working as a high school reporter for the New York Daily News. I had interned. I did internships. I was going to college at Winston-Salem State University, which is an HBCU. I worked at the Winston-Salem Journal, which is a local daily paper. I worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as an intern. And then I get into the business. You know, I start off as a clerk at the Greensboro News and Record. And then I went to high school, covering high school sports for the New York Daily News. And then the Philadelphia Inquirer came calling. And so for me, my claim to fame was that I always called it like I saw it. Even if I was writing a game story, you know, if you played like garbage, I said so. You know, if you played good, I said that. If you played great, I said that. I made sure to do everything that I could to visualize for you as accurately as I possibly could the level of production that you were putting forth. I didn't sit up there and said, well, this person had, you know, shot 2 for 20. If you don't know basketball, you might not think that's a big deal. But if you know basketball, you know that's a very, very bad deal. And so I treated, you know, that average read and what have you, just basically illuminating things for them in a way that made it very, very plain what was going on. And that was always my MO.
Questions about historically black universities, colleges. Sure. First, I know nothing. So,
okay.
Are there any white people enrolled at all?
Yes.
There are?
Yes.
What percentage? Yes.
I'm guessing. I don't know, but I would say on anywhere from 3 to 5%.
And
that might be pushing it.
Is that person looked at as down with the cause or an agitator or nothing?
Nothing. And what I mean, I don't mean they're looked at as nothing. I mean, it's neither. It's neither down with the cause nor being seen as an agitator. Just like you'd have an abundance of individuals, let's say of African-American descent, that go to predominantly white institutions and there are scholarship opportunities, or that's the university that they wanted to go to. And even though it's predominantly white, you'd see some black sprinkled on campus and what have you. Well, you know what? The same is applicable to HBCUs. In order for HBCUs to get government funding, to get assistance from the government, you had to be just as open, you know, to being receptive to white individuals coming to that institution as white institutions had to be open to black people coming to those institutions.
I'm wondering,
so you had to do that.
I'm wondering if there's one white dude who was the first guy to integrate a historically black college.
Well, it had to be at first. I just wouldn't know who the hell it is.
Hmm.
Not me.
Where's our Harriet Tubman? Find this dude's name. Build the shrine.
I got you. I understand. I understand. But I don't know. I really don't. If I did, I would tell you. I'm going to look that up because that's an interesting. Never been asked that question ever. I'm going to look that up. I'm going to try to find out who that is.
It's got to be one dude. It's got to be in the 80s.
Right.
Probably, maybe even the 70s.
Yeah.
It's maybe his probably name.
Probably 70s.
Maybe his name is Marty or Hank. Got to figure that one out.
Figure it out.
What's your power rankings for sport? I know you love the NBA, and I know you love college hoops as well. But I'm trying to figure out where UFC falls
in terms of my
you.
Passion.
And boxing,
in terms of my passion.
Yeah.
Basketball first.
Mm-hmm.
Boxing second.
Mm-hmm.
National Football League third.
Mm.
College football fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it would be UFC at number five. And the UFC, the only reason I say that is because of the actual fights themselves. If you're talking about a main event, if you're telling me that Kamaru Usman is going against Masvidal, yeah, I had to see that.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you're telling me that Ngannou is going against Stipich. I got to see that. I got to see that. If you're telling me, John Bones Jones is getting ready to fight Francis Ngannou, oh, I'm sorry. That's going to move up to number three, number two. It depends on the fights.
Yes.
Pretty much with UFC and boxing, but I love my boxing. I don't want to see a bunch of wrestling. I don't want to see you leaning up against one another, putting somebody in a chokehold or whatever. I want knockouts. Even if it's in the UFC, I want knockouts. And that's why I prefer boxing over UFC. But UFC is fantastic, and those guys are some of the greatest athletes in the world.
I love watching you and Teddy Atlas, and I love watching Teddy Atlas have a meltdown
about
corruption and
boxing.
That's my buddy.
He gets on me all the time. He keeps stop using those big words. Stop using those big words. I could just say, that's ridiculous. Stop using those big words. so he's funny, but that's my guy.
So for you, you start off, you got a lot of brothers and sisters. You grew up in Queens.
Yeah. Youngest of six.
Poverty.
Youngest of six, four older sisters. A brother that passed, he's 9 years older than me, passed away in a car accident in 1992.
Basil. Correct.
That's his name. Correct.
And so for you, what's it look like early? Is it all about sports, but about playing sports rather than reporting on sports?
Are you talking about early in terms of when I was younger?
Yeah.
Sports saved me. From the standpoint that to have what now we know to be undiagnosed dyslexia, to go through that, to get left back. Get left back completely in the fourth grade. I had to repeat the fourth grade because I had a first grade reading level. To go through all of that and then to have my sister Linda teach me how to read along with a friend of the family named Tiver. And then I get to the seventh grade. I overcome that, and I get to the seventh grade, but I'm walking around with that level of insecurity all of those years, feeling like a dummy, feeling like, wondering, panicking every June when you got to take those final exams, and it's going to determine what kind of grade did you get or whether or not you're going to get left back or move ahead because of reading comprehension issues. To go from that to being in the seventh grade at a parent-teacher conference and to have my professor, my teacher, Mr. Caravan, I'll never forget it, look at my mother and say, your son is not a dummy. He's a smart guy. His problem is, it's not that he doesn't know. He doesn't pay attention when he's bored. When he's bored, he drifts. He doesn't hear you. He's not listening. He's not paying attention. Find out what his passion is and you'll have a star in your hands. That's how I got involved in sports. Because I got involved in sports, not playing. You're going out in the streets and you're playing in the park all the time. You're playing football on cement streets. You're playing basketball. You're playing baseball. You're doing all of that stuff. Playing baseball and softball. You're doing all of that stuff, Adam. The difference is that when I say I got involved in sports, that was watching it, studying it, being ready, preparing myself to debate with my dad or my brother or other people that are friends in the neighborhood and stuff like that, and really, really engaging in a fashion where I elevate my knowledge about the sport. That's where it all really, really started.
It's being held back or kept back. Does that carry around the stigma? Because everyone you went to school with knows you were the kid that was held. Is that sort of like being a pedophile in a prison yard or something?
Well, I wouldn't know anything about being a pedophile. But what I would tell you is that you walk around with that on your mind constantly because you feel like an idiot. You feel like a dummy. And kids, you know this, I know this. Very, very few people on the planet could be more cruel than kids. And they don't really know. It's not necessarily their intent. They're just teasing you. They're just teasing you, and they don't mind hurting your feelings, not taking into account the residual damage it leaves behind, the detrimental effect that it messes with you mentally, that it brings to you mentally. And you walk around with that level of insecurity, man. And then all of a sudden, the teacher tells your mother, you are smart. You just got to find something he's interested in. And then all of a sudden, I'm interested in sports. So guess what? Suddenly, not only am I interested in sports, but there's a sports topic that shows up on ABC News Nightline one day with Ted Koppel, and I'm watching it. Or Peter Jennings is talking about some big story involving an athlete. I'm talking about it. Or 60 Minutes is doing a profile of somebody talking about it, or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post. And all of a sudden, you're reading it, and you do comprehend.
Right.
And you do get it. And suddenly you realize, no, I wasn't dumb after all. I just didn't listen, and I just didn't comprehend because I didn't know what issues I had.
Well, you weren't engaged.
Correct.
It's interesting, and a little bit gives me some hope. I was talking to Jay Leno mm-hmm. some months back. He's dyslexic. Mm-hmm. He had a teacher pull him aside and go,
yeah,
like, hey, I know you don't read and you don't write very well. Mm-hmm. Why don't you give, instead of handing a book report in, do a 10-minute presentation.
Right.
And this is young Jay, not a comedian, but that's the comedian part of him.
Correct.
I'll stand in front of the class, and he gets an A. And so it's kind of nice to hear that there are people with their eyes and ears open out there that are in some position of power that can go, there's nothing wrong with you. You're not engaged. But is this a thing? Tell me what this is, because I suffer from this as well, which is once I decide something is not interesting to me, I'm out. And so it could be Real Housewives of Orange County mm-hmm. or it could be a Napoleonic War.
Right.
If I'm sitting there, I'm just like, good students will go, I don't care how interesting this mm-hmm. is to me, I'm in.
Well, here's the deal. Somebody like yourself, who's done a lot of things successfully and you're renowned for it, you have the luxury of being able to make that decision. At this point in my life, I have the luxury of being able to make that decision. Imagine if you're younger and you're growing up poor and you're not aware of your options and you're told this is what you have to do to get out of that abyss, that malaise that you're in, because you got to deal with these things that you have to deal with and you don't feel, you're not aware of your choices. Then all of a sudden it becomes more challenging because of that stuck feeling. I've always admired artists. It could be you. It could be Jay Leno. It could be anybody. I've always admired artists because what y'all don't realize that y'all have is you're brave. Somewhere along the way, you said, F it, I'm betting on me. Most people are about trying to find a good job, particularly when you're younger, you're poor. At least I'm not talking about in this day and age, but as we were coming up, 70s, 80s, 90s, stuff like that, about having a job. My mother was a West Indian woman from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. God rest her soul. And she was a person that was a registered nurse for decades. My mother was about punching that clock, going to work, not missing work, showing up every day, busting your tail to be the best that you can be at your chosen profession and going home. That was my mother's definition of success. Me, I thought like that until I got exposed to other things and saw there was far more to the world than I realized. And I was being hindered and held back from being all that I could be because I was stuck in this rut of believing this is what defines success. That's the challenge. Because when you're younger, you don't know. You just don't know.
Yeah, well, you also come from a place. I come from a place. Many people come from this place where you equate work with two things. It's essentially like I will sell you a piece of my life.
Right.
I will do this thing I don't want to do for 8 hours a day, and you will give me $11 an hour.
Yeah.
And you can essentially lease my life for me. And it's a tacit agreement, but it's an understanding. It's work. You don't get to do what you want.
That's right.
And I started to have these. That's how I grew up. And then I started having these weird flashes early on, which is even if you made $50 an hour, you're still selling your life off for a reward, for a monetary reward.
Yeah.
And then what kind of life is that? It's a better life than getting 11 bucks an hour, but it's still the basic same agreement. Mm-hmm. I will do this thing I don't want to do in a place I don't want to be for X amount an hour, and I thought it'd be so much better to get paid for your work or your ideas or whatever that is, rather than how many hours can I log in this place that I don't want to be in.
There is nothing wrong with that. That is a level of thinking, to me, that should be applauded. We should appreciate it now more than ever before. But I would tell you that as a black man, it's a challenge, because somewhere along the way, you're looking at the power structure. You're looking at the decision makers. And far more often than not, they don't look like you. They don't share your same cultural identity and background and experiences. And because of some of the things that we've dealt with in our society, and I've talked to guys like, you know, I've seen you on Sean Hannity before. I talk to Sean Hannity quite often, his crazy ass self. He's crazy, but I'm good with him. We're good.
Well, and his opinion is definitely his opinion.
That absolutely true. But we talk about things like this. I've talked about it with guys like Mark Levin, to Don Lemon, and others, you know, and our opposite ends of the spectrum, of course. The thing about it is that you're going through those things, and you don't see people who look like you, who identify with you, that make these decisions. And all of a sudden, you'd have to trust that they'll be receptive to it, because the money isn't just printed and handed to you. You got to go out there and earn it. And in order to earn it, you have to have a champion, somebody who believes in you, willing to take the chance on you, you're willing to roll the dice on you, et cetera, et cetera. And you really don't trust it. I'll give you a sports analogy. With baseball, we look at football. The National Football League has become, without question, the most popular sport in North America, okay?
Good.
We see what the National Football League brings to the table. It's a ratings magnet. Mm-hmm. The NBA is pretty damn good. It's doing pretty well. They both have a younger demographic that also gravitates to them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem with baseball? Baseball doesn't have the younger demographic. Their fans get older and older and older every day.
Right.
Because they haven't ingratiated themselves with the younger audience, black, white, and otherwise. Why is that? Here's the reason why. Because unlike those other sports, the MLB, Major League Baseball, is asking for more trust. They can draft you. They can pay you a few million dollars. You still got to go through AA, still got to go through AAA before you go to the majors. And there's a criteria, a litmus test per se, just a boot camp-like period that you have to endure before they decide whether or not you're worthy of being at that next level. Well, in order to endure that, it comes with a trust in the system, not just a trust in your ability, but a trust that your ability will be seen and embraced and accepted and celebrated so you can elevate. A lot of times, black folks have a very, very hard time believing that that kind of situation is going to work to our advantage. And that's what makes it so challenging.
I'll tell you something from the poor white guy's perspective.
Please.
In terms of identifying, which is, I come from a sort of poor, broken down family.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was a guy who looked like me in charge, white guy,
right,
he's running the job.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't identify with him at all,
right,
because he was a successful guy who like went to college and has, mm-hmm, a good family and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we shared a sort of physical similarity,
mm-hmm,
I still looked at myself as a million miles away from that guy because I grew up on the wrong side of the track.
Right.
So there is a part of this that's a sort of physical recognition, like, mm-hmm, he looks like me, and we culturally maybe we like the same,
yes,
thing. But then there's a status part of it that poor people of all colors have a problem with, which, mm-hmm, I think is a big problem, where you just can't picture yourself being a part,
yeah,
of this world.
Yeah, because you're not exposed to it. You don't know any better. And there's no one telling you differently because you haven't been exposed to it. See, that's the beauty of life. For example, although I might lament the state of affairs with our colleges in this day and age, because what education was once worth doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And that's a different subject for another day. What I will acknowledge is that the experience that you get from it, anytime you have the luxury of being able to be around people who look differently than you, that come from different cultural backgrounds or whatever, it's an automatic education. Because by virtue of being around them and seeing their mannerisms and hearing the things that they talk about and communicating and engaging in dialogue with them, you learn more. You just told me something about being a young white poor guy with working for somebody that obviously that isn't the case for them, but they happen to be the white. There's no connection in your mind whatsoever. You have to tell a black person that. Mm-hmm. A black person doesn't assume
that you see two.
Exactly, which is what I'm saying. A black person is not going to see two white folks together and think that they don't share any kind of identity with one another. We're going to look at you as being you, and this is us. And let's find a way to get along. That's what we should be thinking. But we're certainly not going to think that you have no identification with them whatsoever. That's not what we're going to think by and large.
Oh, I got another white guy thought.
Sure.
Which is funny. I was just talking about this on another podcast. I've said it more than once.
Yeah.
I, in almost every house I've lived in, have had a crazy white asshole neighbor. Fucked up, calling Department of Building and Safety, checking unsanitary living conditions.
Yes.
I've had some doozies. I had an old white lady that lived across the street called the cops on me for a New Year's Eve party that she called the cops at 8 in the evening of a Saturday night on New Year's Eve. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. Had another same one called the cops again when our phone lines got crossed. Mm-hmm. It's a long story. I've always said if I were black, I would say I know that person's a racist because why else would they engage in this behavior?
Yes.
And one of the things that I always say is the ultimate white privilege is you get to walk around and go, that person's just an asshole.
Right.
This has nothing to do with my skin color because she's white, I'm white, my crazy old neighbor at the other house is white.
Right.
They're still calling the cops. They're still calling Department of Building Safety. And I get and I would not blame you or David Alan Greer or any black person if you thought this had to be racism because there's nothing else that would justify this.
You're 1,000% right. The first thing we would think, that's a racist ass woman. That's the first thing we would think.
We
wouldn't hesitate.
I wouldn't blame you for one second.
And in this day and age, we call her Karen.
Right.
You know, because of the woman in Central Park. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to call the police that this black guy bird watching. That's what he was doing.
Right.
You know, and so that's what we call it today. And the irony in all of that is I know plenty of black women named Karen. But we're clearly not talking about a black woman named Karen. We're talking about the white woman whose name is Karen. And that's what we're doing. But in the end, you're absolutely right. There's no escaping that. And you do have the luxury of not looking at it as a racist situation because black folks certainly would. We would automatically assume, yeah, it's her racist ass. That's why she's doing this because we're black, without question.
Yeah, I think you'd have there's no logical other conclusion.
Right.
And that's what I would feel when I would live next to these people is what the fuck are they doing?
That's right.
So
totally.
For you, now how do you get to college when you're dyslexic and you've been held back a grade?
Well, I've been held back a grade, but the bottom line is number one, I fixed that before I got to college and I could ball. So I got to Winston-Salem State University on a basketball scholarship.
How good a player were you?
I could ball, I could shoot, but I cracked my kneecap in half my first year, so I never had really much of a college career. I had a college basketball scholarship, and then I cracked my kneecap in half. In high school, you know, I could really ball, I could shoot. You know, I averaged double digits, but I came off the bench because I was 5'9", 130 pounds at the time. You could blow me away for crying out loud, but I could really shoot. And so because of that, that really, really helped me. And I was a street baller, to be quite honest with you, because when you were growing up poor and stuff like that, unless you were the creme de la creme, the elite, the Stephon Marbury's of the world, the Kenny Andersons before him, the Kenny Smiths before him, people like that, you know, because I'm from Queens, New York, so I brought up some Queens names. The bottom line is that you found yourself playing in the park far more often than not. And so in the park, I could really shoot. I could really ball. I could go up against anybody. But I was a weakling. And I had weak knees from playing on the cement all of those times throughout the years. That's me right there. And so that's what happened. And so when that happened, and that's just the way it goes. And I never really had a chance to show what I could do.
Did you have a net on the park basketball?
No.
I hated net.
No.
It was so unsatisfying.
Yeah. In the park, we didn't have it. We was on 204th Street in Hollis Avenue.
At least put one up.
And not only that, at nighttime, the only light was the light hovering over the stoplight on the corner of 2/4 rather, in Hollis Avenue. And the light emanating from it was the only light that you saw where you could see the rim. That's why my jump shot was butter. It was special because there was no net. So all I had was the rim with no net with limited light. So I really had to focus to shoot, and it made me a better shooter. I would shoot like a minimum of 200 to 300 jump shots a day.
It's crazy how much energy you can have towards something you enjoy and it's engaging to you, and how little focus and energy you can have about stuff you care about.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to be bored, or you don't want to be insufficient. Like if you're talking about a subject and everybody in the room understands it but you, you're going to want to talk about something else, you're going to want to leave.
Right.
Now, if you're very knowledgeable about it and you've got 2 cents to add, you're very interested in it. And so it's just that kind of mentality, which is why for me personally, I'm 55 years old. I've got a sports background, but you'll see me talking about politics. You'll see me talking about news, social justice issues. You'll see me talking about sports. You'll see me talking about things that go on in the world of pop culture and entertainment. The list goes on and on. Why? Because I want to maintain my own interest. I don't want to find myself bored by certain subjects and dialogues where all of a sudden, because it dispirits you. And ultimately, you get to a point where you're not that interested in talking about it, and it shows, and that's not good when you're an on-air personality 5 days a week for a minimum of 2 hours a day. I mean, you got to make sure that you're passionate about a lot of things. You can't do that unless you educate yourself, unless you find something that's compelling to you and that you're interested in.
Good. Let's talk hockey.
Oh, no.
I
can't
know.
Do it for you.
I don't know anything. I come from North Hollywood.
Right.
There was an ice rink at the Sears or something 5 miles away. It costs money. If you played hockey, you had to buy equipment.
You ever heard my line about what I say about hockey? You ever heard, I don't know if you ever heard
Tell
it.
Tell it to me. I'll see if
Only
I
thing I know about hockey is that the puck is black.
Yeah.
Mm. That's it. Mm-hmm. I don't know a damn thing else about hockey. And this is somebody that knows the National Hockey League Commissioner, Gary Bettman, who's a good man and has been inviting me to hockey games for years. And I keep promising him I'm going to go, and I'm going to have to go. I got to keep my damn word, damn it. And my daughter, Nyla, wants me to take her with me to a hockey game. And I keep promising her I'm going to do it. And that's what I'm going to do it. But I don't know anything, and I mean anything, about hockey.
Well, you know, when it comes to back to sort of discrimination and sports and getting folks involved and all this kind of stuff, soccer, big international game, the biggest international game, because it's one ball will keep a whole village occupied for eight hours. You know what I mean?
Right.
I've given it some thought. It's got to be true. It's the cheapest way to entertain a whole group of 10-year-olds for the day. All you need is flat dirt and one ball.
That's true.
And football, they would give you the pads, you would check it out.
Baseball, you need the equipment. Even basketball, you need the rims.
A little bit. But hockey, first thing you need is a pair of $80 skates.
Yes.
My parents were out.
Right.
Much less shoulder pads, helmets.
That's what you're thinking. Black folks are thinking about the ice.
Mm.
It's not our thing.
Mm.
Not our thing. You know, I mean, it's not what we do. I mean, you'll find exceptions to every rule, no doubt about it. But black folks ain't interested in ice. It's not what we do. There's basketball, baseball, football, boxing, UFC. All right, fine. Start talking to us about ice and watch what we do.
Sensitive.
It's not what we do.
Racially sensitive question about ice.
Okay.
Black folk, you don't see a ton of them on the water polo team, per se.
No.
Not a water.
No.
Not water. Well, but ice. It's just water frozen, and maybe that would be a good thing through the eyes of a black man.
You could say that. Let me tell you something.
Or
black
it could
folks,
melt.
Black folks don't have any problems with water. We love the beach. You understand? West Indies and beyond, St. Thomas, Tortola, St. Croix, you know, Barbados, all of that stuff. We had no problem with that. You'll see a whole bunch of black people there. Talk to them about ice. I promise you, 99% of them are going to be like, you can have that. We ain't trying to do that. We ain't trying to do that. I'm trying to tell you right now, that's not what we do. You understand? And I mean, listen, you see a lot of folks, and you know, I one of my boys lives in Minneapolis. I literally look at his children and then look at them. How could you do this to them? How could you do this to them? The weather's that damn cold. Chicago. I don't want to see Chicago other than the months of June to September. I don't want to see Chicago. The wind alone, before you even get to the actual temperature, you think about the wind and that breeze and how it hits you. I have no interest.
All right.
Zero.
No ice.
No.
I know nothing about hockey as well, but I will say this. I appreciate hockey. I don't know anything about it, never played it, can't play it, But I look at it and I go, those guys are good.
Damn good. And ice skates. You ever try ice skating?
Yeah.
All right. You good at it?
Not really.
Let me tell you something right now. How far is that TV? What you supposed to 10 feet?
Yeah.
I couldn't make it halfway to there on ice skates.
Really?
I mean, my daughter laughed so hard because she convinced her daddy to go to some ice skating ring with her and her class about 5 years ago. And I swear to you, they were no more than 15 feet from me. And I bust my ass at least three times.
Mm.
At least three times. And I had to just like literally crawl on my knee. I'm a grown man. I'm on ESPN. Okay, people know who I am. And literally, I'm in the ice rink crawling to the board just to pull myself up and literally step by step. You saw that old episode of The Honeymooners when Alice convinced Ralph Cramden, her husband, to go roller skating and he could barely move. That's how pathetic I was on ice skates. It's very, very bad.
I got a sport I like a lot less than hockey.
What?
Lacrosse.
Never tried it.
I don't appreciate it.
Why?
I see highlights. I don't get it. Mm. I did, like I see hockey highlights and I go, whew, yeah. Those guys are fast.
They got fast. They got skills. They can skate their ass off. All of that stuff is true. But lacrosse, you're right. But hey, listen, Jim Brown starred in it.
I know, but then he got out of it immediately.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Back with more Stephen A. right after this. You know, every time I talk to you, I think, ever try stand-up? Because I do feel like that is something you're uniquely qualified to do.
Oh, my God.
And you must have had somebody bring that up a time or two.
Well, my manager, Rashawn McDonald, brings that up religiously. He says I'm a lot funnier than I realize, and he thinks that I can do stand-up comedy. Because I love comedians. I love people who know, who have an art for knowing how to make people laugh. I'm a huge Cat Williams fan. I grew up being a huge Eddie Murphy fan. Of course, I knew about Richard Pryor. And Martin Lawrence can't find a bigger fan than me with his show Martin from years ago from the 90s. Guys like that. And then today you got the Jay Farrells of the world who can imitate practically anybody. And you see Kenan Thompson on Saturday Night Live, you know, along with Chris Redd, who just departed from Saturday Night Live and stuff like that. The list just goes. Monique, I was a fan of, you know, various others. Comedians do it for me. I was a big, you know, everybody loves Raymond. I loved King of Queens. You know, I just love those. I love comedy. And I would tell you, even though I don't think I have a snowball's chance of pulling it off, the one time I was willing to try it was a little over a year ago. It was August 23rd, 2021. And they asked me to host Jimmy Kimmel Live. Mm. Bob Iger, then CEO, who had departed and had emeritus status before he was walking away completely, convinced then CEO Bob Chapek and his number two, Peter Rice, and these guys to let me host Jimmy Kimmel one night. And I said, okay, I always wanted to do it. It was on my bucket list to host late night. And my dumbass didn't realize that, wait a minute. It's about a 15, 18-minute monologue that I've got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be funny.
And you got to read cue cards.
I was scared. I'm telling you right now, I've been in TV for over 20 years. I have never been scared in my life. In my life. And I'm one of those guys that, you know, people get nervous. They're sweating. People get nervous and, you know, they got to get a drink or whatever. Me, I have to go to the toilet.
Mm.
Okay? And sometimes it's just once. This show, in the last hour, I went to the toilet five times. I was so scared that I thought that I was going to shit myself when I went out on stage. Okay? When I went out on stage. I mean, I was that petrified. But the one thing that I had to, and this was the funny part about it. Originally, as scared as I was, I got there. When I got there, I simmered down a bit because, you know, at ESPN, I got a producer here, producer there, you know, maybe one writer, whatever. I walked into Jimmy Kimmel's room. They had 12 writers, man. They had 12 writers, about eight producers every day. I was like this. Oh, I'm good. I'm straight. I got a crew. I didn't know it was like this. This is beautiful. And then we went through and I'm sitting there. No, I don't want to do that one. Let me do this joke. Let me do that joke. And I'm literally picking out. They ain't picking out. I'm picking out the joke. Yeah, I'll do this. Let me try. I could do something with this. I could do something with that. And then like an hour I'm sorry, like 45 minutes before it was showtime, all of those people, the segment producers, the writers and everything, they were looking like they're looking, just sitting around looking like there was a death in the family. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And then I figured it out. They were like, we helped you out. You got the writers here, got the producers here. You on your own now. They didn't say it, but that was the look. You on your own. This is you. And it was that look. And everybody just sat down. And it was like a damn funeral. I'm looking at them. I'm like this. I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then I just walked. And it wasn't until they opened the curtains and they said, Stephen A. Smith, I don't know what happened to me, but the lights came on. And I was just ready.
Yeah.
And I didn't trip over any script. I didn't hesitate. I didn't stumble. I didn't do anything. And that was the only night that I did it. And the only person that had beat me in the ratings was Stephen Colbert.
Wow.
I had the second largest ratings that night at like 1.7 million.
That's amazing.
I was amazed. Now, they never called me back.
How about reading but it is. The cue cards?
No, that doesn't
As a former dyslexic person.
No, nothing like that. I don't have those issues anymore. And a lot of times, more often than not, it's a prompt as opposed to the cue cards. But I have I have no problem reading whatsoever.
I would say prompter, but Kimmel used cue cards forever.
Well, what I do is this. First of all, it's not even a trick. It's just reality. I read the prompter, but I read what's in the prompter before it's in the prompter. Then when it gets in the prompter, I read it again. So I have an idea. And then I also remember I'm not married to every single word and every single syllable. It's the spirit of the content that's in the prompter that you're trying to capture. It's not just reading it. It's about understanding, all right, this is what it is, and knowing for yourself if there's a punchline where you want to pull that punchline. If there's a point of emphasis, you know where that point of emphasis. Nobody can do that for you. You know you. If Adam Carolla is reading copy in a prompter, it could be the same exact copy that Stephen A. Smith is reading. But for you, a point of emphasis might be in sentence 5, whereas for me, it's in paragraph 3. And I know that. And so because of it, it just comes natural.
You know, it's the... Here's the part about being nervous in front of doing shows like that, because I've been there myself. Mm-hmm. The problem is you do a math. You go, the show starts in 45 minutes. They're loading in the audience.
Yep.
They're starting to turn the lights on. The camera guys are getting behind the cameras. And you think, if I'm this nervous now, that when they open the curtain and the light hits me, I'm going to be – if I'm this nervous and I'm sitting in the green room – then how nervous am I going to be when I walk out there?
Right.
And you get fooled by that. But the reality is when you walk out there, your experience and your the way you've always dealt with adversity, mm-hmm. and you know, some people have fight, some people have flight, but it all kicks in, mm-hmm. and you're so much better when you walk out. The most nervous, you know, Evel Knievel was probably more nervous a half hour before the jump than he was in the air.
Yeah.
And that's really how we're all wired.
You know, it's. I will tell you this about me. If you ask me to give a master class, for example, on sports journalism and stuff like that, could I do something like that? Maybe, probably, based on my experience. But this is the God's honest truth. I could. When people come to me and they'll say, you know, I want to be just like you, man. I want to do that. And I tell them, no, be the best you can be. Because I'm naturally me. I'm myself. And when I go in front of a crowd and the lights are on, Adam, I can honestly say from the bottom of my heart, I don't know what happens to me. My brother-in-law, he's right outside. He brings that up all the time. My sister acknowledges it as well. When the lights come on, man, I'm just up. I don't care if I had no sleep or 10 hours sleep. I don't care if I'm exhausted or wide awake. I don't care if I'm stressed and depressed or just ecstatic. It doesn't matter. When the lights come on, I'm looking at the audience and I'm imagining them looking at me and I see nothing but them. And it's me. They're watching me. I'm not watching them in my attitude. They came for me. I'm giving them me. Whatever me is, in that moment. And that's how I am every morning on television. I can't tell you, man. Look, man, I got to get up at 6:30 every morning. I got to be have a morning meeting at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. I'm on the air at 10 a.m. And I'm literally on the air live for 2 hours each day, 10 hours a week. And that's just one job. And I got three. But when the lights come on, I have more than three, actually. But when the lights come on, I don't know what comes over me. I'm never tired at that moment. I've gone a commercial break and go like this, like literally exhausted. And then the minute the light comes on, I'm wide awake, energized, and ready. Yeah. I don't know what to, I don't know
well,
how to explain.
It's a blessing. I always put it this way, because mm-hmm. I used to box and teach boxing, right. And I would say, 9 out of 10 guys, they get punched in the face and they think, man, that hurt. I don't want to get hit again.
Right.
1 out of 10 thinks, oh, I'm going to kill this guy for punching me in the face.
Right.
That's the guy who's a great boxer.
Right.
It's not natural.
Yeah.
Most everyone gets hit once and goes, yeah. What? That yeah. hurt. I don't want that to happen. But if you're angry yeah. and you think, now I'm going to punish this guy,
right.
then you'll usually be a pretty damn good boxer. And that's the same way with the lights.
Yeah.
I'd say 9 out of 10
yeah.
lights go on, people seize.
Right.
But the one comes up.
I don't know how to explain what's happened.
I think it's kind of a gift, almost yeah. like the guy gets punched in the yes. face and gets angry instead of scared as a gift.
True. Allen Iverson, former star player in the NBA, good friend of mine. I'm sitting down in 2008. I'm interviewing LeBron James. And before the interview starts, you're a reporter. You don't want anybody interrupting you. You don't want anybody saying anything, giving somebody a heads up, doing something like that. You know, you're ready to flow. And before the interview started, Allen Iverson walks up to LeBron James. He said, bro, I don't give a shit what you think you see in front of you. Pointing to me. He said, you don't see no pen or paper. You don't see no notepad. You don't see no notes, no anything. He said, don't you think for one damn second that this motherfucker, Stephen A., don't know exactly what he wants to ask you, what he wants to know from you, and what he intends to get out of you. He said he knows. So he said, I love you, and I love him because, you know, we just talk like that. But he said, keep your guard up, because if you slip with one syllable, he's going to catch you. He knows what you said a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. Don't think for one second his ass doesn't know. And I was like, well, damn, you done messed up my interview. You know what I'm saying? He said, I'm sorry, I couldn't let LeBron go out like that. I had to let him know. I had to let him know. And that's what he said. He said, you don't drop your guard. He said, at this, and his exact words is, at this shit, he was talking about broadcast journalism. He said, that's that dude right there. And I always remember that.
I wouldn't think a guy who doesn't want to practice would prep a guest that way.
That's right. That's right.
Very interesting. That's right.
But I tell you this much, he didn't want to practice, but guess what? We see load management now, dudes missing games all the time. When you see Allen Iverson doing that?
Never.
That brother showed up. He just didn't want to practice beforehand, but he showed up.
He was the funnest to watch
yeah.
because, I don't know what he was, 6'2"?
6 feet.
6 feet,
six
even.
6 feet, 165.
Yeah, so even, it's funny, I thought he was small, but I'll tack on 2 inches to a small guy in the NBA because they're standing amongst giants,
yes.
you know what I mean? But
yes.
he was always the most fun to watch because it's one thing to watch a 7-footer dunk or
yep.
a 6'8 guy dunk, but yes. seeing a 6-footer dunk yep. and do the stuff he did is just so much more visually entertaining.
I mean, when he told you he was a warrior, he wasn't lying. I mean, he walked in, and I can't tell you how many times, you know, as a reporter, remember, this is different now, because even though some people do it, when I was a beat writer for the Philadelphia 76ers.
Oh, that's right.
Right? I'm sitting courtside. They come to the scorer's table. So, Adam, they're walking right by me. I mean, if you smoke some weed, I'd smell it right on you. The minute you walk by me, you sit up there and you're sick, I could tell. You got an attitude with your coach, I could tell. You're getting in an argument with your coach or a teammate, I'm right there. I'm seeing all of it. That's how close I was. And I'm telling you right now, I saw dudes looking at situations, and it was written all over their body, the nervousness, the paranoia, the fear. I remember when I was playing, I was nervous, paranoid, fear, scared if I made a mistake, the coach is going to pull me out, all of this other stuff. Allen Iverson worried about none of that. His mentality is, they got to worry about me. That's how he was. Kobe was like that, too. But even though Kobe was like that, Kobe had Shaq at the beginning. Allen Iverson didn't have that. And he was a warrior, and his attitude is, they're going to have to come get me. They're going to have to come get me because I'm coming for them.
Yeah, we're sort of getting back to the boxer who gets punched and gets angry instead of getting scared. Yeah. And Stephen A., when the lights show up, you show up, and Iverson had his own version of that. It's situations that would intimidate, scare, and stifle, and hurt the performance of most. And yet they perform better.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know that you can train for that. And I don't know that you can rehearse that or practice that.
And
I
think everybody's that just different because we live in a society where they want rules, regulations still, and you can't blame them because when you leave people to their own devices, some people operate better off of that, but more often than not, you got people trying to get over. In the case of Allen Iverson, when I was covering him one time, the night, I don't know if you remember this because I know you know your basketball a little bit, he dropped 58 points on the Houston Rockets.
Mm-hmm.
It was against Stevie Francis, Cutino Mobley, and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Allen Iverson was being crucified because he had gone on like a slump where he was just awful over just awful over 10 games. Couldn't hit Broadway if it was empty. It was bad, right? What people didn't know, but I knew, Allen Iverson had made this commitment because he got tired of his wife, of Coach Brown, Larry Brown, and Coach GM Billy King, Pat Grocey, and everybody lecturing him about needing to get home early and, you know, be professional, be committed. And he just went on this kick for 2 weeks where he said, I'm going to go home early. I'm going to get my rest. I'm going to go to bed. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to hang out with the fellas. I'm not doing anything. And he was awful. And he said, excuse my language, fuck this. I can't take this no more, Stephen A. I can't take this shit no more. And went out to Fridays on City Avenue in Philly at the time and was out till like 3 a.m. Showed up late to practice, was sleepy or whatever, and went out there and dropped 58. Yeah. And I looked at Larry Brown and I said, you just got to leave him alone. You just got to leave him alone.
The, I don't know. Like, you know, LT would do some horn and some coke and go out and have 3 sacks.
Well, LT would send the porn stars or the prostitutes to the rooms of the competition. That's what he would do.
Ah.
He would send it to their room the night before games.
That's what
LT said he would do.
I should tell LT that's what I'm thinking about playing. Send a whore over. Stephen A. Smith, the book is Straight Shooter. It is available as you hear this. And you can shoot him a tweet at Stephen A. Smith as well. Stephen, always great to talk to you.
Time flies by.
We'll do it again whenever your schedule permits.
I appreciate you, buddy. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right.
Well, there's Stephen A. Smith. Very interesting guy. And that's it for the show. West Palm Beach, Florida, Improv, February 16th. You just go and then off to McGoobies in Baltimore. And you can, that'll be 17th, 18th. Just go to AdamCarolla.com for all the live shows everywhere. And until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Eleanor Kerrigan and Stephen A. Smith and Max Batta saying mahalo.
Make sure you get a copy of Adam's latest book, Everything Reminds Me of Something. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and get your tickets to see the Ace Man. Get them now at AdamCarolla.com.